Hello, this is Mark Steiner, and welcome. You're listening to Soundbites and The Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and on Delmarva Public Radio, WSDL 90.7 FM, and WSCL 89.5 FM. We're about to hear the second part of our series, Surrounding Food and Faith, with a fascinating panel that I moderated earlier this month at the Pleasant Hope Baptist Church in Baltimore, Maryland. We brought you the first part of this good food gathering last week. And today, we'll hear the remainder of that panel, Teaching Well, answering how we can educate our youth, adults, and communities about good food. This is the intersection of food and faith. Our guests were the Reverend Dr. Heber Brown, pastor of the Pleasant Hope Baptist Church and a community leader, organizer, educator, and facilitator Ari Witkin, and doctor of naturopathy Dr. Jeanette Hablula. This is a collaboration between our program Soundbites, the Center for a Livable Futures Food and Faith Project, and Interfaith Power and Light. Food is deep part of all our cultures, whether it's from Easter dinners to Passover dinners to breaking the fast in Ramadan. That food, we can each name 10 holidays inside of our tradition where food is huge. And I'm not one of these Puritans that don't have a good piece of apple pie, and I want my apple pie. So I'll have my apple pie. But the question is, I'm curious what real role we can play. You said Arabers earlier. Most people in this room know what Arabers are, right? So when I was a kid, the Arabers were everywhere as well. They went to everybody's neighborhood. They were all African American, but they went to everybody's neighborhood, selling vegetables and fruit and more. What's to stop the people of faith from creating gardens and food and plots of land that are actually distributed in our city with Arabers, whether they're on horse carts or whether they're driving little electric carts? I don't care how it goes, but that is a system of delivery, right? And deliverance. You got me to church now.
So I just want to speak about this cool project, which my partner actually runs with an organization called Chazon in New York City, which is Chazon means vision. It's a Jewish environmental organization. They do a lot of different things. But this program that Liz runs is a CSA network, and she helps congregations across the country. I think she has 170 synagogues now across the country that have CSAs in their congregations, and they're distributing food in their synagogues to their members, partnering with local farms and local farmers, sometimes a group of local farmers. And along with that, I know we're here tonight to talk about education. There's a whole educational component that comes along. So people want to get their food from the farmers market, from Whole Foods. It's popular right now. We gotta roll with that. Sometimes I like to push back against what's popular, but I think this is one of those things we gotta really grab onto because it's good. And you're getting fresh food and you're getting an education with it. And so maybe not all your food is coming through that CSA, but it's one model. So that's a national model. I think there can easily be local models of CSA distribution points at congregations. Does everybody know what a CSA is? I'm sorry. Community Support Agriculture. I saw some yeses, some no's. A CSA is like, it's like buying a share of a farm. So you pay up front or through a payment plan maybe in March or April. And then every week during the growing season, that farmer drops off at your house or you pick up at a location a whole bushel of fresh produce, which is what's in season and what you're supposed to eat. Your body works on a season. The ground works on a season. It produces certain food, and you can eat healthily only eating the things that are growing in season. So it's a way to get local produce consistently and support farmers who are outside of this agribusiness monopoly. So that's one really cool model that I wanted to lift up.
And I want to say, like going partnering with that, we have a program, speaking of the Arabers, that it's similar. There's a farm in Pennsylvania, in Warfordsburg, Pennsylvania, called the Farm of Peace. And they have the CSA. And they have drop sites. They're taking Halima right here in this front row. She's the director of that CSA. They're going to Sterling, Virginia. They were going to Silver Spring, Maryland, where we were going to pick up, and we were driving 45 minutes to pick up our shares. Going to Frederick, Maryland, working with the farmers market in Berkeley Springs. So you talk about going around and taking stuff to different neighborhoods. When I would pick up my share, they would give me extra to take because I work with a Muslim, it's a women's shelter that's run by a Muslim woman. It's not just specifically for Muslim women. It's called the Women's Affairs of Al-Mumtahenna. in Baltimore. They have two houses, shelters in Baltimore. So they would give me to give to the women's shelter. So I'm getting fresh organic food that would be picked either that morning, Saturday morning, or the day before, fresh food that I could take to these inner city women who couldn't get it, who had no way of getting it, don't have transportation, don't have access to the organic food. So that, but that's like, now that's coming from Pennsylvania all down in through here into Virginia, into Maryland. But however, what you're talking about locally, what is that Jonah's house, the nuns, the Jonah house?
Jonah's house.
The
Jonah
nuns
house, yeah.
Growing in their neighborhood and distributing to the people in their neighborhood. So we can do it more locally. And if we had something closer, we probably would, I probably wouldn't be driving 45 minutes to get to, you know, pick up from my drop site, or driving the other 45 minutes to pick up my raw milk from Shrewsbury, Pennsylvania. You know, but, you know, it's illegal to sell raw milk here and cheese and all of these.
You know, there is an underground.
You know, yeah. So, well, we drive into Pennsylvania and, you know, purchase at a drop site on a parking lot, you know. But we can begin to do these things. Again, it's co-oping, partnering. And for those who don't have the money, because people say, isn't that expensive? I don't stop to do cost comparison, because I realize there's some things you cannot put a price on. You cannot put a price on knowing where your food comes from, knowing the people who are handling your food, being able to be sure that that food is grown properly. You can't put a price on these things. So I don't do, but women who can't afford it, they were donating and giving. So somebody was buying extra shares. So if you can afford it, then you do extra and put in for those who can. That's what our faith is supposed to be about.
Again, can I say very quickly, in addition to what's been shared, that idea, Mark, is actually one that has stayed with me. It's been a couple of years now.
The Arab idea.
The Arab idea as a part of an alternative food system, particularly in Baltimore. I think we are uniquely positioned as a city to really get some traction around alternative food system, and I think the Arabers can play a tremendous part in that. In addition to the faith communities as well, I talked to Darielle and Valerie and many others about this idea of particularly black churches connecting, those who are growing, connecting and creating a network where we engage in strategic growing and planning of who's growing what where. And then as you walk past and came through the front door of Pleasant Hope, you saw our church bus right out front. Many of the churches across this city have 15 passenger church buses. I see church buses driving all around the city, taking people and food with the existing resources that we have to help create this food alternative food system. And I think it can do so much more than just provide good food, because in my just a little bit of time on these issues, I've recognized that where there are food deserts, particularly in Baltimore, that's only many times just one symptom of an already depressed community, right? And so it's not just food deserts, but also there's justice deserts in these same communities. There's a desert of quality education. We don't just need good food, we need good jobs. And so when we have not only siloed communities, but when we have segregated conversations about this, sometimes we just focus on good food and nutrition. No, black folk need jobs in Baltimore. You know, poor people need economic justice in Baltimore. Is there a way for us to look at this issue through a different kind of lens and prism, and an alternative food system not only can provide good food, but now you got opportunities for jobs for people. You begin to create the economic engine, sustainable economic engine for people to get engaged, because that is their interest. And if we start with their interest of not only food, but jobs, and then a sense of purpose and mission, we are creating something, as you said, the underground. This alternative food system, I think, can really go a long way in not just attacking food deserts, but what many have called zones of abandonment across the city. And we know Glenn Ross is an East Baltimore activist who first introduced me to this phrase that says that ghettos are created. That we can go nowhere in the city and see these depressed communities and just say it dropped out of the sky. No, many times check cashing places are in these communities. Many times it's poor schools. Many times it's crime, public safety issues. These are zones of abandonment that have been created, and an alternative food system can help begin to turn the wheel to transform these communities.
Let me throw this idea out. I read a piece today by Chris Hedges, who is a radical thinker and came out of the church first before he became a war correspondent and started writing his books about society. And what he wrote in this piece today was we have to come back and grab our imagination, he was saying. We have to reclaim it. We have to reclaim the sacred in us, the sacred our understanding of the earth, the sacred of our ideas, being not afraid to be on the edge and pushing those ideas. The only people who make change are the ones who push the ideas on the edge. The sacred of between us as human beings. The sacred of our faith traditions. And not letting this, what he called postmodernist era, control everything that's going on. So that's what I'm saying. That it seems to me that communities of faith, no matter what they are, who they are, coming back to the understanding of the sacred. How does that play into this? I mean, how do you see that as being part of the key of change?
The whole thing about sustainability, there is no way that the universe that is divinely created is going to sustain anything that is in opposition to that divine creation. So when we understand that our survival, that our very lives and our integrity and our you know, well-being is based on staying within that sacred reality, the truth. And I mean, this is something that, you know, again, using our, what you call sanctuaries, you know, this opportunity, you have people coming, they're in a group, they're sitting there waiting to listen. And we don't use these opportunities. I mean, this is, you know, and use it for something that is meaningful to people. I mean, meaningful. Sometimes, you know, I mean, I'm just going to be realistic. I go to the masjid on Fridays, our day of, you know, our main worship, and I'm there, and I'm like, you know, speak to me about something real, about something related to our lives, about something that we need to help us make the needed changes and to become more aware, to become more grounded, more centered, based on our faith. Yes, based on our faith, but real in this time, what we need now.
That is, I'll take that. You know, you just helped me get ready for my sermon. let me make sure I'm preaching something real this coming Sunday. I think the charge and challenge is important, that the imams, the clergy, the rabbis, we all need to be pushed, priests, fathers, we need to be pushed to make sure that we're in tune and connected, not just in the clergy bubble. But I'll say as well that for me, one of the things that I strive to do as a Christian pastor is get people to, at least folks who come and gather here, get them to think about the sacred beyond some of the traditional ways of thinking that that we're accustomed to. And so for some people, the sacred is wearing dresses down to your ankles and carrying a 50-pound Bible and making sure you have a cross around your neck and you wear your Sunday's best. But I like to push that and stretch that and think about, for example, you know, it was sacred sitting around Big Mama, Mama Geraldine's dinner table on Sundays after worship. That's sacred. And in that moment, Big Mama was the woman of God who helped bring people together around food and family and connectivity. Why can't that be sacred? Why can't we think about not just Chick-fil-A connections, but what if we also thought about, you know, let's cook together and figure out what we're going, you know, how we're going to create some type of new meal together. That's sacred, right? And so stretching the bounds and boundaries of sacred. And what I found, Mark, is that when we talk about sacred in that way, then the people who would not self-identify as particularly religious people, or people who, you know, I don't get down with organized religion, or I'm spiritual but not religious, all that kind of good stuff, or the people who got mad and left church 20 years ago, when you talk about the sacred in the everyday, then people can come back to the table and say, okay, there's a place for me here. I can get with this. I may not be able to sing all your hymns, but I can get with the importance of coming around grandmama's table and smelling them biscuits in the air. And I'm with you, Mark. Apple pies. Thank you for the good food movement. Can we talk about apple pie and bread pudding? I mean, we can make it organic, but don't take the good food off the table now. But if we talk about that and to get people to understand that connection, I think it's particularly powerful as well.
I want us to think a little bit about ritual for a second. Jewish community and Jewish tradition is really good at ritual. And I think sometimes it's not as fun or as exciting. I don't think our community is as good at talking about the spirit and the way we're moved by an experience, but we're really good at talking about the practicalities of it. So I go to Jonah House to learn about spirit, and I go to my mom's to learn about ritual. And we have a lot of ritual around food. And Heber, what you're saying is right on. Eating is a spiritual experience. Eating is a spiritual experience, and we shouldn't forget that. And I think the way we ritualize eating is really important. Sometimes it seems burdensome or overdone, but in our community, we have different blessings for every kind of food. You don't say the same blessing over
fruit that you say over potatoes, that you say over bread, that you say over pasta. There's a different blessing because not because it's supposed to be complicated, but because it's amazing that God created so many different things. And if we don't take the time to recognize how amazing it is that we have apples and oranges, not just one big bundle that tastes the same, like that's incredible, right? So raising that up, I think, can bring our awareness to eating in a different way. I think it's really important. I also think giving thanks for food is really important. Everyone has their different way of doing it. Jewish community's traditional Thanksgiving prayer after eating is laborious, just plain and simply. It's longer than the meal. It's huge. But, you know, it took me a long time to learn that. I went to Jewish day school, and, you know, we'd have like 15 minutes of lunch and like 12 minutes of grace after meals and then back to school. And I was like, God, what if I could eat for 20 minutes? But it's really amazing to think about that our tradition has built in a model of giving thanks for food that is longer than the process of eating. I just want to note how fundamental that has been to who I am. And just to close on this again, it's like, Mark, you asked how we bring the sacred. Eating is sacred. Eating is sacred, and everybody does it, and we can bring that alive for everyone, the people who've left the community, the people who don't want anything to do with it. And the most common thing I feel, and I speaking from my own traditions, I know I have a lot of peers. For those of you who are in professional religion, you probably know that my generation, the 20-somethings, were sort of dropping out of the institutionalized religious community. I have a lot of peers. The Jewish community, we talk about a lot about how do we engage the millennials. Most of my peers don't want anything to do with a synagogue, with a church, with an organized thing. And my friends who grew up in the Jewish community, they don't want to touch it really. They're sort of confused by it. They have negative feelings of Sunday school or whatever. They're sort of like wary of my decisions to pursue that. But they will never turn down the invitation to a Shabbat dinner. Like, never. And not just to come to eat, but there's an experience of ritualized meal in a weekly pattern that brings something to life for them.
Please, join us.
Hi, I'm Jerry. I live in the neighborhood. I live in Chinkopin Park, right down the street. And so I was really excited to hear this would be in the neighborhood. And leave it to a Baha'i to stand up and, like, go away from, like, ritual. But I think we really have to think about, I guess, the sacred in individuals. So if we really loved one another, we would want to support our health and our well-being. We would want to see ourselves not eating poison. We wouldn't want to leave it to, you know, we see children, they call juice, and it's like a colored drink, you know, Kool-Aid kind of drink. Leave that as a choice. We wouldn't allow our institutions, governments, and corporations to specifically poison us so that some people can't even eat out of what's in the grocery store, and you have to find alternatives. So I think that love is sacred, and that if we truly loved each other more than we loved ourselves, it is better to prefer your brother to yourself or your sister to yourself. And if we preferred one another to ourselves, we would not allow ourselves to be poisoned in the way that we are. But I I've been admiring the garden next to the church for some time. I even took pictures of it a couple of months ago. And there's an initiative that I want to do called Be More Square. So I'm a certified square foot gardening instructor, where we could take lumber that's not being used, like scrap lumber, and make gardens that people can have at their door. Because one of the things I find is that people, like that extra effort to go to the community garden is just too much effort for them. But if it could be by the door, high enough so you didn't have to bend over, and you could grow your favorite five things, maybe. Like, that's something that we could make accessible, and we could recycle lumber and do all those things. And it's this great idea I have and want to do, so if anybody's interested. The other thing is, last summer, the Baha'is who are doing children's classes in Poppleton community, the children had planted all these vegetables and made this garden in an abandoned space. And then the contractors came to mow, and they had squash and tomatoes, and they were on climbing up, and beans, and like huge harvesting food. And it was all mown to the ground. Like, they mowed it to the ground. And so another thing that brings meaning and purpose is resilience. So people from all over the community came to help the children who are not Baha'i children. They're children in the Poppleton neighborhood. And a lot of the adults are not Baha'i adults. They're adults who want to help those children have a garden. We came together, we replanted, and they still had a harvest in the fall. So I think also that resilience that we won't be held back, that is also sacred.
Communities of faith who have roots in neighborhoods and among populations of people, how do you all think that begins to change? That you can help control that change, foment that change? It's not going to happen overnight. We're not going to get the juice boxes out of our children's faces overnight. It's a long struggle. But it is a struggle, and it's a political struggle as well as a spiritual struggle, and they're deeply connected. So how do we begin to do that? I mean, how does Earl Alamein's mosque in Walbrook Junction, or your church here, or wherever that might be, come together to figure out ways to change that, controlling ground, growing food? That's what I was trying to get to earlier when I was talking about the Arabs. Really, sometimes I think it takes the idea of having to have, through the churches and synagogues and mosques and temples, to have an alternative way of doing things, a separate track to bring people together to do things that we're not doing in a much larger way.
If I can, I think it goes, one of the things to consider is to go back to what Ari said earlier about that strawberry. Because I think that before we can talk about ways of doing, we have to create safe ground for ways of thinking, right? So alternative ways of thinking precede alternative ways of doing. And so, again, for us, it was, as a pastor, I am extremely privileged. I'm afforded degrees of privilege in this space and in this system that I want to use responsibly. And so what that means is if y'all going to give me, and for those who are, you know, more familiar with the Black church tradition, pastors in the Black church tradition have enormous, enormous influence, particularly if you have a certain generation. They have enormous influence. So what that means for me is, and just to get real practical for a moment, because you got people listening who are members of churches all over the city and area, as a pastor, not only is can sermons be preached to help create can help turn over the ground of the mind, but also getting into the veins of your ministry so that the Sunday school, so that the different, you know, various ministries of your church in different ways can find their place at the table. But again, it goes back to just thinking something different. And once that ball starts rolling, from my experience, it takes off in directions that you can't control. And that's why I get really excited that when you get to places where the imagination is just rolling so much. I mean, for many, and I'm so glad that Jerry raised our garden, we call it Maxine's Garden. Maxine is a member of this congregation, Miss Maxine. She is 80 what, Tanya? 80, Miss Maxine? 80-something. Maybe she might not want me to tell her age across all of Baltimore on the radio, but she's 80-something. But she has the type of tenacity and strength that will put us to shame. I mean, she's in early in the morning, late at night. For those of you who go by, you'll see her. That's Miss Maxine. Just give her blow a kiss and give her some love, because she is the heartbeat of our garden. But once I created space in this ministry for that, it was Mama Maxine and others who said, now we can do this, then we can do that, then we can do that. But it starts with turning over the soil of the mind. And once that starts, look out. Avalanche is coming, and I'm excited by what can be.
My name is the Reverend Meredith Moise, and I'm just so happy to be here. This is such a vital conversation for our community. Just briefly, I used to teach in Prince George's, and the school I taught at lunch, it was catered. And I noticed that the children were eating horrible food. It was like chicken boxes and fries every day. And then on top of that, they were washing this stuff down with soda. And people would literally, the kids would get into fights over which soda they wanted and who got the hot sauce, like violent fights. And I was working with children that were emotionally disturbed. So you had all this stuff going on. And we literally had to beg the principal to change the food. And she wouldn't do it. So we took it upon ourselves to call a company from Annapolis that specialized in organic food. And they came and did a taste test. It was only then that she was convinced. I can tell you 6 months after we changed the lunch, these kids were eating fresh food every day. I mean, like carrots and celery and these things. The fight stopped. The fight stopped. And even though the principal didn't believe that there was a correlation between the soda and all the junk, and some of the kids were medicated and some of them weren't, and their behaviors, she couldn't see that. So my question is, what do you think is the impact, right, of this artificial fake food on the mental and spiritual health of not only our children, but the communities from which they come?
Well, you know, I guess sort of like that's one of my specialties, but I mean, the thing is, when you know, I've had people, I used to have a radio show, and I also was on a radio show, and I had the people who would call, I was calling show, talk show. So when people would call in, the people who I had, like, really telling me, oh, you can't say that, or you shouldn't, about herbs and natural foods, and because the research is not there, and et cetera. The research is there. It has been done. You know, if you study one way, you read certain things. You study another way, you read certain things. So the MDs are reading certain things, and holistic doctors and naturopaths are reading a whole different set of research. The research is there for the effects on the children, on the organs, on the brain blood, you know, things crossing the blood brain barrier, getting into the brain, affecting the way that you think, the way that you act. I've seen it. I've witnessed it. How do you get people, though, to accept this? And they have to see it, just what you had there. You've got to make that change. I saw it in the Islamic school, the Rahma school with the Islamic Society of Baltimore. You know how they have the government-provided breakfast or whatever? One day it was like chocolate donuts and chocolate milk or something like this. That kids, like first graders, rolling up their hands ready to punch another one for something. And I'm like, and I'm thinking, I'm saying to myself, knowing what I'm seeing, what can I expect? And I've got to wait for this stuff to wear off, some of this sugar and stuff. And when it wears off, even in a day, you know, the change can come, the negative of change can come within 2 hours and or less than that. But the positive change can also come. And once you get that stuff out of their system, like you said, you are going to see personality changes. You talk about that crime, changing the crime atmosphere, change the diet. People can become more peaceful. People, the love that you're talking, the woman was talking about, you know, when you really, I mean, the effects are just, you can't imagine. I mean, we can't even, but the thing is, you cannot sustain a divinely created organism with false food. We are real. I have one CD that's titled Whole Food, Whole People. You will not be a whole person eating this artificial food.
That was Doctor of Naturopathy, Jeanette Hablula. You also heard Ari Witkin and the Reverend Dr. Heber Brown. We have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. When we come back, we'll hear more of this conversation.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com.
back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and on Delmarva Public Radio, WSTL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM. And we're listening to part two of a panel I moderated last month at the Pleasant Hope Baptist Church in Baltimore that was part of a Food and Faith project, a series called Good Food Gatherings. This one focused on teaching well, and we answered the question, how can we educate our youth, adults, and communities about good food? Our guests were the Reverend Dr. Heber Brown, pastor of the Pleasant Hope Baptist Church and a community leader, organizer, educator, and facilitator Ari Witkin, and doctor of naturopathy Dr. Jeanette Hablula.
Hello, my name is Talia. I'm 17, and I'm very passionate about environmentalism, which is great. But when I'm trying to share that passion with other people, I run into a slight barrier because young people, unfortunately, are not taken very seriously for, like, sometimes for good reasons, sometimes for not so much. But especially when I'm presenting my ideas to adults, like I want to have a garden within my school, and I can see my teachers are kind of like, oh, that's cute. but how can I present something I'm really passionate about and I think is really important in a way that people are willing to listen to? And that goes for all youth. How do we support youth, and how can youth better and more eloquently like present these ideas to adults?
First of all, I think you're hitting on a much larger issue than questions about environmentalism and food. The way we treat youth in our culture is way off track. I think when you have a specific project that actually makes it easier to bring forth the knowledge and the passion you have as a 17-year-old because you can focus it. I think just crying for youth voices to be more recognized is a huge issue that as a society we need to take on. And I think for you as a passionate young woman with something that really lights your fire, that's a great way to start because you know about food you eat. You know about what you want to do, and there are some great advocates and tools to make that happen. I don't know what school you go to, but I think every school should have a garden.
And I would add to that if you find that you can't do what you want in that particular environment, in that school where you are, then look for whom you can partner with, because there are groups of young people who have the same passion that you do, and you just have to find them. And I think the other thing is to not become discouraged or to give up. And I mean, I know a lot of stuff is done on the internet now. I don't know if that's how you will find them or how you'll find them, maybe. You know, a lot of it is on the internet. There's a group in D.C. called the Green Muslims, and these are young people, you know, high school, college age, and they're doing things in all different places. But I'm sure there are other people. And so if you can't make the garden at your school, find where you can do it, because there is a place. And and while you're doing that, maybe do something at your home so that you are utilizing, you know, I mean, not letting that energy just sit inside of you and sort of, you know, just almost like make you want to burst. Find a way to let it, you know, be applied and work at it and you know, let it move into the world. Because anything that you put out, even your good thoughts, I mean, it is creating something. It is developing something. This said, I read something that said one negative thought can change the balance in the universe. And positive thoughts can also change things. So you don't give up. You keep your goal in mind, and you keep finding ways that you can, you know, collecting stuff, whether it's the wood to build the little bed or the seeds or whatever you're going to do, so that when the opportunity comes, you're ready.
I was speaking to a group of young people the other day about this, and I think something you have to always keep in mind, being 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, whatever your age is. Those of us who were in the Civil Rights Movement, the anti-war movement in the early 60s, we went to jail, fought for what we believed in. We were 17. We were 18. We were 20. We weren't 40, 50, and 60. We are now. We were right then, and we're right now. When we said the war was wrong, we were right. When we said segregation has to end and put our bodies on line for it, we were right. So just because you're 17 doesn't mean you're not right, and you don't have the power to be right. Sometimes the old people have to wake up and remember they were 17 and were right, and you're right. So, and there are a lot of other people out there like you, your age, who want to do what you want to do in this community. So don't let any old person back you up. You have to fight for what you believe in and just stand up. 17 is right.
That's a great sermon, Mark. I think that I'm ordaining them for the night is out, Joe. But I just want to co-sign. I mean, that's exactly right. And I would say that by and large, it's a general statement, but by and large, adults are terrible at being real allies to youth. We're terrible. We are terrible at it. You put 15 teenagers in a room and they're having a meeting and there's one adult in the room. That one adult will work to dominate or steer the conversation in the way that is appropriate to what they think is appropriate, rather than have those 15 young people to, in their own way, craft and shape what it is they want to do. We are terrible. We need training. And we need training from you and your peers as to how we should be allies with the things that you you feel divinely bubbling up in your spirit to help make this world a better place. So I would say that we need your training. We need your help. We are infected with the disease of dominating everything when it comes to intergenerational partnerships. And with your support, we can be better, but we're not going to get healed without you. I'll say that first. And then secondly, I just want to speak the name of Ella Baker. Yes. I just want to speak a name. And I speak her name because while Mark is right that there are a number of those of us who are affected with the disease of being old folk, but there are also the Ella Bakers of the world. For those who may not know, Ella Baker was a central and gigantic pillar when it came to advocating space for young people to help change the world. We would not have SNCC if it was not for Ella Baker. You wouldn't have a lot of the Greensboro move. We wouldn't have all the. Ella Baker was the one who, in many ways, she was shunned by other adults, but she would fight to make sure that young people had space. I believe her spirit is yet amongst us. And that if you look for the Ella Bakers in society, in your community, in your network of people who will put their necks on the line to make sure y'all have the room, I think it can happen. So for your principal, don't say your school name and nothing like that. I don't want to get in trouble. But I would say your principal and your school may not be listening to you, but find Ella Baker. And you go to that office with Ella Baker. And Ella Baker says, we're so thankful to be partnering. What's your name? Talia. We're so thankful to be partnering with Talia. She has a wonderful idea, and we want to get behind it. And in fact, we're so serious. Here's a mini grant of $500 to get things started. And slide that check across that table to your principal. And then watch her face change, and her ideas will change. Because now you brought Ella Baker with you. And now that principal will look at you differently because you've shown that you have the chutzpah. Is that a word y'all use? Chutzpah? You got the chutzpah to find an Ella Baker to come to the table to put her neck and put his neck on the line for an idea that should be supported.
I want to say one more thing because Mark inspired me with his talks of civil disobedience, and one of my teachers, Rosemary, is sitting here, and I know she loves civil disobedience. I don't know if you know what a seed bomb is. I think a seed bomb is an amazing thing. It's exactly what it sounds like. It's a bomb full of seeds that grows food, and you can make them, and you can throw them at the grass in front of your school, and doesn't matter if they want you to start a garden or not. Food will grow there. It's really incredible. I advocate for seed bombing. I'm 100% behind it as a peaceful means of bombing the world with beautiful, beautiful fruit and vegetables.
Peace and blessings, Hotep. My name is King Teasdale. My mother is 82 years old. She had surgery about maybe a year and a half ago, which kept her from her gardening. She is that type of person with the resilience to be back out there. And she started last year with her okra, her potatoes, her collard greens, et cetera. And I think it's important for us to recognize that people are influenced by what they see. We need to develop what's necessary. And Dr. Brown, I would believe that we have a serious connect here because a lot of things that you just said is what I had just wrote before you said them. And it is about connecting our elders with our youth because my mom comes from the South. She knows about gardening. She knows the whole deal. There's no hit and run. And she shares that with her family members and they have a network that they know exactly what to do and how to go about doing it. Our youth are waiting for that instruction. And I understand that this gathering is about the teaching well. We need to find a way to develop grants that are necessary so that our elders can connect with our youth so that when they come together to make this happen, it's going to work. The biggest problem we have, and because she's my mom, I'm going to do whatever I can to make it happen for her. But we battle rats in the city of Baltimore. They want organic food more than we do. And they're fighting for it. But we need to fight against them in order to make it happen for us. So I bring to the panel that question. What can we do in order to develop what is necessary for the grants and the funding necessary so that we can battle the rats at the same time so that we can get the gardens up and running like they need to be? Because once we get them in our community and the people get to see what these gardens are, then we can have those community markets to show people that we have food right here ready for you, our own produce, and show what economics can be about. I think that's enough.
I just want to say that everything has its natural enemy. And at the Jonah House, where they got the llamas to protect the llamas are protecting the goats, and then the guineas are keeping the mosquito population down and other guinea hens. So you got to figure it out. I mean, I don't know about the rats, what you do, but everything has its natural enemy, and so you have to get that under control. Or just like when we use marigolds or different plants to keep out certain enemies, we put it around so you put out what they will stay away from, and that, so you need some help maybe figuring that out, but there's an answer to it. And then in terms of, I can't speak to the fundraising and grants and stuff like that, except that when you talk about the historical thing with the black population, we didn't go to other people asking for anything. We pooled our money. We started schools that developed into universities. We made,
Preach!
And eventually had our banks and our, whatever. So we can do it. Yeah, I mean, we can do it. It's a matter of co-oping that money, But the thing is, we have to learn to trust each other. I think that's the big thing. People don't trust each other. You start to put the money together, and then they look at it, everybody look at it, I'm taking my money out, No, we have to learn to trust each other. And so, build those, organizations in the neighborhoods, in the communities.
Well, I have two comments on funding. One, I want to raise up the Center for a Livable Future and the Food and Faith Project that are convening us this evening, because they've been terrific at funding congregational and community gardens. I don't know where that project is at, but I'm sure if people speak to Dario, he could tell you about it after the event. So that's a great resource. It's been I know that at Pearlstone we partnered with CLF to help start 9 gardens and Jewish institutions in the city, and I know that Heber also has been a partner in that project. And so that's just one tangible resource. And the other thing I would say is that different than a lot of community programs, gardens have a sustainability component in that they produce a sellable product. We need a change in the way our food system works and purchasing works in order to value locally grown organic produce in a different way. But there's an income generating stream built in, if we're talking about community institutions and nonprofits, gardens are already better than 90% of nonprofits, right? Because they have a product to sell. We can raise money by selling what we do. So just something to think about. I don't have the business model laid out for you perfectly, but it's something to think about. I don't know much about rats, though. I can't talk about that.
Quickly, my name is Angela Kukui, and I'm a youth advocate. I run a nonprofit where we promote arts in the city. I'm also a preacher's kid, so I grew up in the church, and I love my church, but as much as they can convince me that Jesus walked on water, I can't prevent them from putting that ham hock in them stream beans. So this faith base is really helping me with my father and my family, telling them, look, this in the Bible, you have to, live healthy as well as preach healthy things and healthy choices. where I service the community is right near John Hopkins Hospital over near Church Square Shopping Center. And we try to provide healthy choices for the kids while they're in our environment. But it's so hard to do that when you have the carry out on one side and then the carry out on the other side and the carry out literally footsteps away from the center. When you don't eat the food, because I don't eat it, the smell just takes me back because it's so strong. So when you say it comes in there and that scent, I can't, it's hard for me to take it, but if you're adapting to it, it's like, this is really good. I'm going to go there instead of eating this apple. So I'm just wondering, with all of these programs, the accessibility to these gardens or the accessibility to the kids that are in these inner cities that don't have access to much, what is it that we can do as nonprofits that we can promote to the churches? So we go to the churches in the area. It's called Church Square because it's four churches on the corners. But I don't see the promotion of the healthy diet for the community. So my question is, how do I start as an advocate for the community accessibility to these healthy foods so it'll be easier for me?
Reverend Brown. It's time to open the church door, right?
Yeah, the doors of the church are open. The doors of the church are open. I would say, and I'm very familiar with that area. In fact, I was just there earlier today at Faith Baptist Church for a meeting. And so I would say to find a way, find the congregational champions for these issues. Oftentimes, you know, that may not be the pastor or the leadership, right? As a PK, we know that. But there might be some champions in the congregation, and starting with them, and let them work the internal congregational politics to know who to talk to, how to get stuff moving in their local church. I know one of the things that a lot of churches, including Pastor Maddox and so many other pastors down that area, are always hungry for is exciting, relevant youth programming, right? They're always looking for something that's constructive, that people are going to tweet about and put on Facebook about. This is what's going on in my church. If you got something already that you can package and put together and working through the channels of each church's, you know, the way they plan and programming, I think that might, you know, serve the interests of the leadership. They might, so pastor may not get excited about apples and, you know, all that kind of good stuff. But here's a program where your young people are going to have an exciting, hands-on experience right here in their community. It's going to help to transform not only the community, but your church as well. So, I mean, kind of just looking for that internal congregational champion. You already got a product. Packaging it in such a way that's going to align with the interests of the leadership at that church might get you a running start, or at least some steps. And if all else fails, call me and let me do the pastor to pastor call and say, my cousin down there working at Church Square said that she got a program. I claim cousins in a minute. So just, we can work it out. Just talk about it later.
Can I just say something about hope? Working in the holistic field, what I have found is that once you begin to balance the body and put the good things into it, the desire for the harmful things becomes less and less until it really becomes repulsive to you. And so then it's not like you're forcing something on the person, but they themselves are refusing what is not good. And so that this is like a hope. If you start, you have projects where the children are fixing food, and if you educating also the parents where stuff is happening in the house, those things that are, you know, out there in their faces, they're going to walk away from it. They'll just start leaving it. And, you know, the thing that's keeping these businesses going is because people keep patronizing them, you know. So once, if they find out that if they're not going to offer a certain type of thing, that people don't want to come in there, they're going to have to make changes. So just, it's long term, but it is hope. But I have seen it happen. I've seen young people change within months. To where, you know, I had one young man, he was addicted to Mountain Dew, which is very addictive, and he also liked to eat at these fast food places like McDonald's and whatever. And so he came, but he asked me to help him with, you know, just health. And he was maybe early 20s at that time. And then when he came and he said to me, he said, you know, I went to the gas station with a friend of mine, he brought me a Mountain Dew, and I looked at it and said, what'd you buy me that for? And then I said, well, that's what you always drink. And he said, yeah, but you could have got me water, you know? And it's just, and then he went someplace else, went into the McDonald's and looked at the menu and didn't want anything. And then he said to himself, oh, my God, I'm changing. You know, I'm changing. So this is hope for the natural thing that will happen within the system, the holistic system, that you begin to not want things that are harmful. It's a natural thing.
That was Doctor of Naturopathy, Jeanette Hablula. You also heard R.A. Witkin and the Reverend Dr. Heber Brown.
If you have any feedback on today's program, please email us at steinershow@gmail.com or tweet me at Mark Steiner. You can also listen to today's episode or any of our past episodes online at the brand new soundbitesradio.org. Take a moment to visit us there. Leave your comments. Check out our work. And thank you so much for listening.
Let all associate, therefore, in this great human garden, even as flowers grow and blend together side by side, loving all religions and all
Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites are a production of the Center for Emerging Media and made possible in part by a grant from the Town Creek Foundation. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer at WEAA is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Public Radio Delmarva is Christopher Rank. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, and find out information from the interviews we are doing on this program, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download our podcasts on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and for WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM, Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's one word, MarylandEducators.org. Or you can go to SteinerShow.org and click on the Maryland State Education Association's banner.